I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and irregular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an irregular warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. This is Bill, and welcome to episode 42, Storming America, The War Comes Home. A little bit of housekeeping before we get started with this continuation of the series that I've done that sort of upsizes and upscales the prospects of a possible invasion of America. So I'd like to thank, of course, all of my listeners and readers of my essays and dispatches at my Substack for paying attention to that, writing to me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. There are a variety of ways to get in touch with me to include that for email. And then, of course, on my Substack page. And one of the primary reasons why I wanted to get the Substack page up and running was so that I could entertain comments and have conversations with my readers and listeners about the stuff that I've been speaking to. I now have a YouTube presence. It is very low density as far as audience scores. I would urge you to go on there and subscribe if you get an opportunity. I'll be sure in the show notes for this, and even in the notes for this particular episode on my Substack, to include how you can get to YouTube and sign up and subscribe, as so many folks who are on YouTube urge you to do. Subscribe, hit that like button, which may be. Now, I've done that in order to expand the reach. So I'm on a variety of podcast venues, everything from Spotify to Apple to Amazon and everything in between. I was urged by some of my listeners to give YouTube a try. I'll give it a try. I haven't put a whole lot of effort into the way it looks because I don't know what the return is going to be on increasing the number of listeners and or readers that I may have to my podcast, and as I mentioned, my dispatches, which are my essays that I do in the interregnum between my fortnightly cadence and issuance of podcast episodes. I would also urge you to go onto Twitter and follow me there, where on occasions I will post things. I'm at W. Buebert, that is W-B-U-P-P-E-R-T. That is my Twitter handle, even though it reads Chasing Ghost Podcast when you go on there. And again, I'd like to thank everybody for your solicitude and loyalty in listening to this since I began it, a little over 18 months ago in September 2022. And here we are. And I'm at episode 42 now. I'm closing on 100,000 downloads, which is, I think, a minor accomplishment. And I have nobody to thank for that except all of those of you who have chosen to take the time out of your busy lives to listen to these podcasts. I'm often asked what I'm reading, so I will let you know a couple things I've been reading. Yes, I do read several books at a time. And yes, I do have a cadence to my reading, which is 2 nonfiction, 1 fiction. And I found that if I discipline myself that way, I'll be able to indulge in more stuff that is substantive and may even be more related to the podcast content that I'm trying to generate now and in the future. Now, Carl Dahl wrote a book called Factions. Fascinating contemporary at the time, maybe going back 20 years, even though this was published several years ago, where he talks about the factions in an underground world that is reminiscent and adjacent to the John Wick universe where they created the Continental in that entire underground, much like what you would find in the Parker series. That would be Richard Stark's 1960s, 1970s lean and mean crime noir that inspired films like, I'm certain some of you may be acquainted with or have seen the film of Mel Gibson, Payback, a gritty neo-noir crime thriller that was pretty loyal and a very good representation of Richard Stark's work. Now, there is a Parker collection out there that was illustrated by Darwin Cook called Parker. One of the books would be The Hunter, the other one would be The Outfit, and several others that you can see where they, like the John Wick universe in which the Continental creates, unearths, and reveals this hitherto unknown criminal underworld organization that seems to layer over the entire Earth. And to a certain extent, I don't know if Karl Dahl in Faction and the second volume, Faction, with the Crusaders, and of course, the first volume, highly recommend both of these books. The first volume deals with that sort of contemporaneous end of the 20th century, early 21st century homage to the neo-noir crime thriller and really interesting characterization, tight narrative, great writing, highly recommend it. Now, in With the Crusaders, the second volume in the Faction series, Dahl goes back to the 1930s, to the Spanish Civil War between the anarchists and the communists and the nationalists in the Spanish-American War. And he talks about the various things that started that. Now, the reason I find that interesting is that I hate to admit this to my audience, but when it comes to the Spanish Civil War, my knowledge of that is probably not what it should be, nor is it up to snuff for me to even do an episode in a literate fashion right now and provide you the analytical heft that I hope you've acquainted yourselves with in these podcast series when I do them. So I'm not ready for that yet, but I will be in the future. But he has certainly piqued my interest in trying to find a way in the future to have probably an episode or a series of episodes that talks about the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. Because a lot of what we see then, remember, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it does rhyme. A lot of the things that we see happening there, you can see those nuances and indicators and warnings occurring before our very eyes here in modern-day America and the West. Haven't finished the book. We'll enjoy the book because so far, so good. Factions with the Crusaders. Karl Dahl does a terrific job and just a very talented writer. What am I reading in nonfiction? Well, Peter Caddick Adams wrote Sand and Steel, which was this massive treatment, I think in excess of 1,100 pages, massive treatment of Normandy. Now, not only June 6, 1944, and the aftermath of that war and the clash between the Allies and the Germans and their allies on that front, but also he goes back and provides us with all the details and the sausage making that went on before that that set the stage for what would become, but wasn't inevitably, a successful invasion, knocking down the door, knocking down the barriers into Western Europe, so that the Germans in 1944, hence from June to December, would have to be dealing with two fronts in their war instead of the single Eastern Front, against which four-fifths of the entire German OB, until their surrender on European Theater of Operations Surrender Day in May 1945, they would predominantly put four-fifths, maybe a little less, of their total order of battle against the Russian menace in the East. Finished Sand and Steel. He has a second book, which is called Snow and Steel, which talks about Bastogne. And then, of course, I haven't gotten to this one yet, and I'm just finishing up Snow and Steel, where he talks about Bastogne. And of course, the reverberating after effects of the Allied debacles in Holland under Operation Market Garden. And, of course, being kicked back on their heels in the surprise offensive in the Bulge in 1944, where the Germans have this last gasp, massive offensive against the Western Allies, not the Eastern Allies, against the Western Allies in the very cold and snow-blanketed forest of the Ardennes. Now, I'm paraphrasing here, but Caddick Adams makes a very interesting observation here. He makes many interesting observations, of course. But one of the ones he says is that one of the reasons why the Allies were caught in such a massive intelligence failure on predicting or forecasting that this very large offensive would take place, and when it did take place, they were taken by so much surprise, is because as a rational martial actor, Hitler would always surprise everybody, because in the end, Hitler was a very irrational strategic actor. Hence, as I've reflected on in prior episodes when we talk about intelligence failure, you need a red team, you need to have the 10th man in the room, you need to have the folks there who are going to offer the contraindicators, who are going to offer the counterfactuals, who are going to question every nugget, every larger detail, every largest detail in a given plan or analysis or forecast, and say, well, through stoic drilling and through Ono's five whys, well, why are we doing that? Why would that be the case? What would they benefit from? So, again, it gives a great insight into that. Kadok Adams' last book is called Fire and Steel, which apparently covers the ETO, European Theater of Operations, up until the surrender of Germany in May 1945. I'm looking forward to that as soon as I finish Snow and Steel. I find these trilogies are really interesting because it gives you an in-depth examination. I've spoken in the past about, I'll go through these phases where I read many books on the Pacific War, to include Ian Toll's trilogy, which I highly recommend to anybody who wants to be acquainted in a very detailed and sensible narrative fashion what happened in the Pacific during World War II. And as is my wont with these multi-volume treatments of history, in this case, Jeffrey Cox did a terrific book called Rising Sun, Falling Skies, the Disastrous Java Sea Campaign of World War II, in which from December 1941 to March, April 1942, the Japanese centrifugal strategy of besting the Dutch, the English, the U.S., and other minor allies in the Southeast Asian theater was almost absolutely complete in and its totality was astonishing to watch. And the amount of contemporaneous, if not spontaneous, because these were rather well planned, these contemporaneous events taking place at the same time, because remember, in December, they made the attack on Pearl Harbor. But in December through March, and in December, by the way, they bested and sunk the Prince of Wales and the Repulse, two capital ships, to which later on Churchill says was one of his darkest days when he received the news that the two ships that he had sent there to secure Singapore were sunk by naval aviation. And of course, as I've mentioned before, this is also a revolution in military affairs, especially when it came to naval warfare, because up until December 7th, 1941, the battleship, for the most part, was going to be, in the eyes of most naval imagineers, excepting the Japanese, of course, was going to be the dominant platform to win naval battles. Turns out that naval aviation was that very thing, and not the 16 or 18-inch guns of the American and Japanese battleships, respectively. He also wrote a tremendous three-volume trilogy on Guadalcanal and that campaign, both naval and military. And I would also recommend, if you're interested in Guadalcanal, here we are, we're going on a list of books, aren't we, is to look at James D. Hornfisher's book, Neptune's Inferno, about the naval campaign. And I also consider Hornfisher, who we tragically lost several years ago to cancer, young guy, I think he was in his 50s when he passed on. That's too bad. One of the best chroniclers of the U.S. Navy campaigns in World War II. And then his last book before his death was about what the Cold War Navy was shaping to look like between 1945 and 1960. And I also read that. Highly recommended. So I will include these titles in the show notes. Folks were asking me what I'm after as far as what I'm reading. I'm reading all the time. How do I read all these books? Well, I do a number of things. Number one, I read the books. Number two, I have a Kindle. So if I'm waiting in line at the bank teller, I'm reading. If I'm driving, I'm listening to podcasts, which means that on occasion, heavy traffic can be a blessing to me. So those are the books I'm reading. On a final note, I live south of Tampa on the Gulf Coast of Florida. So just by happenstance, every year, Special Operations Forces Week, which used to be SOFIC, which was the Special Operations Forces Industry Conference until Global Soft reflagged it to read SOF Week. I was just there. Fascinating, huge exhibit halls, great to go there, meet folks who I haven't seen in a while, meet with folks and network with folks with innovative new services, products, things like that. And of course, just the vibe of being around some of the most fit and intelligent and mischievous people that I've been around in my lifetime. Great to meet folks that I haven't seen, which means that back in the day, I spent almost 2 years in Afghanistan. On my second tour in Afghanistan, I was mentoring, coaching, and training 5th and 10th Special Operations Battalions, referred to as Kandaks, in the Afghan National Army, near the Uzbeki border, out of a German-Dutch base in Mazar-e-Sharif. Not only did I meet great Americans and great Europeans and great other folks from other organizations as we all put our shoulder to the wheel of trying to train and improve the armed forces, but of course, I worked with Afghan INDIGs, and in this case, I worked with ANISOC, which was the Afghan National Army Special Operations Command. And in those battalions, we were training special forces and commandos. So one of the seminars that I attended, because it's a very interesting topic to me that I don't think gets enough attention, was a moral injury summary. By the way, hats off to SOCOM and the Joint Special Operations University to bring four bright-eyed and credentialed human beings to a seminar on moral injury and discuss this in a sober fashion, allowing questions, things like that. So during this seminar, I asked a question and made a comment concerning moral injury because I had done a previous episode on this very thing, and I think it's a big deal. It's not necessarily related to PTSD, even though it doesn't mean that you can't have it as a result that is adjacent or because of the moral injury that one has PTSD. I am proud to say that I do not have PTSD, but I do have moral injury. So at the conclusion of the seminar, half a dozen young Afghans came and they embraced me and thanked me, and I was absolutely gobsmacked and just, I'm not the most emotional guy, but I did get emotional. I met with them the next day. I'm going to, again, put my shoulder to the wheel to help them with immigration issues, job issues, things like that. But these are surviving members of folks that I taught there, because when the Taliban regained control of Afghanistan after the American departure in August 2021, the Taliban placed every ANISOC member there on the most wanted list, in the hit list, and went after their families with hammer and tong. So many of these guys, fortunately, were repatriated to the West, especially in America. Now, shame on me for not paying enough attention to this, but now this reunion with folks who I had trained has inspired me to get to work. And in future episodes, I will talk about the work and probably put out pleas for whom to send money to, offer services, volunteer, whatever the case may be, to repatriate them with their immediate families, their extended families, and make it easier for them to transition while here in America. So that it touched me deeply. I wanted to let folks know about that because it was just extraordinary, and serendipity and synchronicity and karma works in strange ways in our life. And I wanted to thank all those gentlemen for just making my heart skip a beat and making me feel as if what I've done in the past on occasion does matter now. Episode 42, War Comes Home. Now, if you'll recall in this Storming America series, in episode 37 and 41 respectively, which were the first two in this series about what's going to look like a supersized October 7th Gaza invasion if it comes to the West, and in this case, America. A quick review. In episode 37, I talked about riffing off of two books, one by Kirk Schlichter, which was called The Attack, and another book by William Fortune, which was called Day of Wrath, a novella more so than a novel. And in both of these books, what these gentlemen did, Schlichter purposefully and Fortune serendipitously, because he wrote his book 6 years ago, Day of Wrath, is they talked about what it's going to look like when a cell rises up spontaneously, contemporaneously, and starts to wreak havoc in the American homeland over a 1, 2, 3 day period of time, could be longer than that, if they were to upsize and upscale and replicate what happened October 7th with Gaza in Israel last year, where you had several thousand militants from Gaza. Hamas took credit, but I'm certain that there were a number of volunteers from other organizations or even unorganized militias that were in Gaza proper who conducted this particular operation against the Israelis. A number of questions were raised, among which was, well, how did this happen intelligence-wise? And I addressed that in episode 41, where I talked about intelligence failure now and forever, and the fact that for the most part in the West, in the English-speaking world, or in the Yiddish-speaking world, in the case of Mossad, Shin Bet, and the other intelligence organizations in Israel and in the Israeli Defense Force, one has to ask, well, why didn't they call this? Why didn't they see it? I examined that in detail in the previous episode. So if you're interested in seeing some of the suppositions and premises and conclusions I came to concerning the intelligence failure, I would ask you to look there. But I would also tell you that this intelligence failure is de facto a part of bureaucratic intelligence communities, period. Rarely, as I talked about in detail there, do you find Western intelligence agencies, in spite of the fact that in America, for instance, $100 billion is acknowledged to be spent on intelligence in the first place, that is that money producing the kind of actionable intelligence, the kind of prediction and forecasting modalities that allow us, especially the U.S. as a global hegemon, to prepare itself for these kind of attacks? And the short answer is, no, it doesn't. Now, in episode 37, in my research for that episode, I found some astonishing statistics, which I'm going to share a little later in this episode, about the kind of atomistic need to have people with weapons on them at the very time that these unpredicted or unforecasted attacks take place. And all of a sudden, you have men, women, and children in the hazard who either may be able to defend themselves or can't defend themselves. So this is going to be an aggregate assessment that is going to draw deeply from Fortune's observations and from Schlichter's observations in their books, where they talked about, well, what's going to happen on the ground when these attacks actually take place. Now, both they have a number of suppositions that they make. Their suppositions are this. The planning takes place where on a given day, a green light is given, maybe a Monday or a Tuesday, for attacks to begin. As far as Day of Wrath is concerned, you have Islamic jihadists who are pre-positioned in America in numbers reaching probably 500 to 1,000. In Schlichter's book, reaching in excess of 1,000, in which you have 5 to 25-man cells. The cellular structures are ideally probably going to be 5 to 10 men, and then you will have 5 to 10 cells of those 5 to 10 cells, which would comprise, that would be driven by cell leaders. And with that cellular infrastructure, what happens is that if one of those cells is compromised or one of the subcellular structures is compromised, it means that all the other ones, because they're led in a fashion in which one cell doesn't know of the existence of the other, nor do the cell leaders know of the existence of other cell leader structures that are elsewhere in America in this case. so that they can't be sundered as far as mopping all of them up at once. So I want to make a point of why it is so advantageous for these to be Islamic insurgents. Islamic insurgents have a built-in mechanism, which is suicide and the will and the impetus to fight until they can fight no longer, whether wounded or dead. Sort of like Schlichter calls them fire and forget weapons, where once all the cell leaders have all their respective cells in the area or region that they are operating in, all they have to do is simply send out a coded message via secure messaging or a coded message via open source comms, let's say a cell phone, where a certain word or string of words is read out, and they know that in a given period of time or immediately, they can begin hostilities. Now, in this case, what makes them so effective, of course, is that not only is it something where they're not going to have to be directed, but it's fire and forget. Once this goes, the only time the violence will stop that they will start is once they are either captured or they are wounded or they are dead, and then it stops. No direction from other operational or strategic levels has to be granted to these cells once they are in play to do what they want, because the main reason this is done is because, as Caleb Carr tells us, terrorism is the use of violence against non-combatants to achieve political ends. Now, we can expand and tease out and try to make better sense of that quote, but we're going to let that quote stand for now, because what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to grok the fact that once this happens, the primary reason these attacks will take place is two things. Number one, it will shape the conditions for the political ground in the U.S., and if this were to happen in Europe, the same thing would happen with our allies in Europe. And it's also meant, as Osama bin Laden did with his $2 million minus investment in 9-1-1 to take down the towers and take over those airlines, was in the end, as he told in his fatwas in the 1990s, he wanted to shape the conditions and incentivize political leaders in the U.S. and the West to go to war in the Middle East, to spend trillions of dollars on said war in the Middle East, and inevitably, if the track record of the West waging war in the Middle East were true to form, that would mean that men, women, and children would suffer in incalculable ways and in violent fashions that would further strengthen and stiffen the spine of all resistance throughout the Middle East to Western invasion and occupation. Now, in the following prognostications, I am making assumptions about the intelligence community in the United States, of which $100 billion a year is spent. There are 15 after 9-1-1. There was a director of national intelligence, which became the overarching umbrella organization to direct the CIA, the DIA, the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and all of these organizations in their intelligence collection, expansion, surveillance, and actionable targeting that they would do. Now, as I told you in the previous episode, episode 41, none of that has met with success. Most of that has met with massive bureaucratic institutional failure. But for those of you with your eyes open looking around, you would be able to arrive at those conclusions well before I told you here on this podcast. Now, the targets in Fortune's book are going to be elementary schools and middle schools, with a prediction that once it became clear that they were under assault by armed terrorists and insurgents, parents would make their way to the schools no matter what they were told through traffic arterials and such. So there was a secondary effort once the trap was sprung with the schools and slaughtering and doing other really foul things to the children in these schools in Fortune's book, that parents would go there no matter what they were told and make their way there. So there was a secondary insurgent network that was operating on the arterials leading to the schools, where once one had disabled, neutralized, or destroyed a vehicle or two, the traffic pileup would be massive. You would have immobile cars. You would have unarmed folks. And so the insurgents in Fortune's book could casually walk along and take out a number of people, wounding and killing countless dozens, if not hundreds, leading to thousands of American deaths simply on the traffic arterials, much less the awful things that were taking place at the schools that they were also filming and transmitting over the internet to make the terror even more manifest. Now, in Schlichter's book, which harkens sort of to Max Brooks' book, son of Mel Brooks, World War Z, in which he uses an after-action format where a number of interviews from people directly involved in the event are ex post facto being asked, well, what happened on that day? And they relate those narratives so that they can describe them. Schlichter does the same thing in his. And his is a three-act book in which it's the prelude to the attack itself, and then what are the manifestations in society after the attack has been met and resolved? What does America do in turn to stop that from happening in the future? No spoilers in this for the end of both of those books, but they both come to radically different conclusions on how the American government would react. Schlichter more optimistic, and Fortune, I think, more realistically. Much more pessimistic about what would happen to America as a result of that attack, and it doesn't have anything to do with expanding freedom and liberty in Fortune's case. Now, both of these gentlemen, sign of the times for Fortune, maybe Schlichter chose not to entertain it. What you find in both of these is that you have these teams of 5, 10, 15 men, numbering up to 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, who contemporaneously, spontaneously, across the entire country, from the East Coast to the West Coast, attack major cities, attack smaller cities, attack burgs. In Schlichter's case, the sequence is going to be for 24 hours, they will attack schools and public places. The next day, day two, for 24 hours, they attack residences. The next day, for 24 hours, they attack key infrastructure, vulnerable infrastructure, and those kind of attacks. Now, of course, the assumption made by the attackers is that on each day, the police community and the government entities on the second day will be at the attacks will be at the locations of the attacks taking place on the first day, so that in this case, the residential areas will be completely wide open because the cops will have gone to all the public spaces and the universities. And then there's on the third day, they attack infrastructure. And of course, the cops and the government entities are going to respond by securing residential areas, thereby making the infrastructure attacks even more vicious and effective because no one is there to protect them. Because what they've done is they've extrapolated, well, they're always going to fight the previous war, so they're always going to go to the previous place. So it's rather savvy and brilliant in its own exposition to do that very thing. I think that expectation should take place in America if this attack were to take place. All of these entities and organizations and fighting cells, in this case, Islamic fighting cells, in both of these books, take advantage of the fire and forget that I just talked about, and they fight until they are either restrained, wounded, or killed. And they keep fighting until that time. Like I said, when you think about it, it's a terrifying premise to think that they let loose these terminators, as it were, into society on given days that are pressing and neutralizing and causing catastrophic damage, to include killing, raping, murder, to Americans, in this case mostly unarmed Americans, to affect the political outcome that they seek, which is either the destabilization of the American government, were this to happen in Europe, that respective government, or to make it react in a fashion that is negative to the Americans themselves. Now, I'm not going to say either Fortune or Schlichter were wrong. I think they're approximations of a single most accurate picture of what this kind of mass assault spontaneously on America. And remember, I use that word spontaneously to mean everything kicks off at the same time, regardless of the time it is on the respective coast, because a lot of planning will have to go in to this to make it happen, even though these cells are basically, they receive the message, fire and forget, and they go forward and they become masters of mayhem. Schlichter and Fortune both make the point that, well, wouldn't it be better if they were to somehow diminish, neutralize, or destroy the internet? Well, no, that wouldn't work well. And both of them came to the same conclusion that I would, because you want the internet up and running, because in this case, both authors postulate that these terror cells are going to be taking very awful videos of their activities, and they are going to stream them live on the internet. So you can imagine the kind of terror and discombobulation and just sheer paranoia that would infuse in the country on that day that wouldn't go away for weeks, months, if not years. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm not faulting them for missing out on a couple of these addendums I want to make to what that attack will look like. I have no doubt there will be armed attackers, that they will have either a Kalashnikov pattern or Stoner pattern semi-automatic firearms, or even automatic firearms. There are things that can be done to the Stoner platform, for instance, with simply a piece of metal that makes it fully automatic. But fully automatic in the hands of folks who don't know what they're about with rifles, well, maybe we'll even include pistols in this case, they're not going to be able to cause the damage that they normally would with that, because automatic fire, for the most part, is used as a suppressive fire for more accurate fire to take place when firing and maneuvering. But nonetheless, I'm going to make an assumption that they have access to fully automatic weapons. Maybe they're carrying 10, 20, 30 magazines. I think in Schlichter's book, it was between 20 and 30 magazines. Maybe the same for Fortune. They had hand grenades. They had ID explosives. In this case, that would be improvised explosive devices. This could be everything from a car bomb, a V-bed, to an explosive device that is handmade, like one may see in the movies, where it could be dynamite, it could be lead pipe, it could be any number of expedient devices that are meant to cause explosions. And one thing that I think, as a matter of fact, I think it was Fortune who mentioned it, they had fake ones, fake ID devices. Imagine what that would do if once they get into some kind of institutional structure, whether it be residential, whether it be a mall in a public space, or it happens to be a residential apartment building, and they come across what appears to be bomb-like or ID devices attached to the doors, apertures, windows, stairwells, whatever the case may be, that is going to slow down response time tremendously, because they'll have to call in the EOD teams, the explosives and ordnance disposal teams, from either their local law enforcement agencies, or if they just so happen to be near a military organization, from those facilities to come in and neutralize the bombs. An alternative addendum to what Schlichter and Fortune talked about in their books, and I'd love to hear from my listeners if you have other books that explicate what this would look like, maybe not necessarily reflective like Schlichter is directly on the Gaza attack last year on Israel, but some kind of attack by any kind of outsiders, to include ones who may not be jihadist. For instance, in this case, both books entertain the fact that these were Islamic jihadists who were conducting the operations. Another disturbing aspect in Schlichter's book, and Fortune didn't tease at this, was that university students, and my gosh, we've seen over the past few months what that kind of allegiance looks like, would be actively assisting them as trigger men, auxiliaries, bomb makers, bomb throwers, or simply plugging up 911 lines with fake calls to make sure that the cops during the conduct of this invasion are doing everything they can to gum up the works, as it were, for 911 call responses. I don't know if that would quite be the case or not, but who knows? If it happened, I simply wouldn't be surprised. So my addendums to what Schlichter and Fortune talked about are that I think you're going to see a far greater use of drones by these kind of cells. I think you're going to see a far greater use of bombings and destruction of critical nodes. For instance, if this were to happen in the summer, what would happen if they targeted in either large office buildings or at malls all of the HVAC equipment on the roof somehow to destroy it in total? It would cause tremendous harm for weeks, if not months at a time. The infrastructure attacks that take place on the third day in Schlichter's book, a lot of that infrastructure would not only be electrical grids, but it would be bridging. It would be traffic signals. It would be charging stations. Imagine with the EV craze that has consumed America, especially in the big cities, if they managed to make it so that every time one plugged in a Tesla or an EV of any type into a charging station that was available to them, that it made the cars explode either then or a little bit later. Because as we all know, fire departments have had to go back to the drawing board as far as how they attack and neutralize the fire from an electrical vehicle, because some of these electrical vehicle fires simply can't be put out with what firefighters normally carry. I mean, I've heard that some of the heat can go as high as 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Gasoline-powered vehicle fire burns at about 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. For a vehicle, typically it will take about 2,000 gallons of water to extinguish a burning combustion vehicle, a gasoline-powered vehicle. An EV fire will take 10 times as much. So if one is at a place where you don't have a hydrant available, it must burn in place. And you can imagine all the problems that would cause. And what if at these charging stations they managed to make it so that an explosive device or whatever was done to make that EV explode didn't take place at the charging station, but took place, let's say, program 30, 40, 50 minutes later, where it is in an internal parking garage at a building in a big city? You have a 5,000 degree torch that's burning in the basement. What does that do? What does it do to vehicles that are surrounding it? So in this case, I think they'll use drones. I think they'll use EV vehicles as a particular manifestation of causing this kind of chaos avalanche that would bloom across America with all of this kind of destruction. Will they have shoulder-fired missiles that are AT-4s or Carl Gustavs, which would be a ground-to-ground? Most likely not, because you don't get the bang for your buck that you do with that. Because with small arms in America, one can take out vehicles. Now, will they be equipped with Stingers or maybe Russian variants? And in this case, most likely Stingers, because during this 3-day campaign, and it could be a 5-day campaign, could be a 10-day campaign, who knows how long it's going to take to neutralize all of these people when they initiate their violence against America on a mass basis. Well, what's going to happen if they do have these Stingers and all of a sudden they go proximate to a local airport, most likely an international airport, to get more bang for their buck, and they start knocking aircraft out of the sky? And of course, you'll want to be knocking aircraft out of the sky that are on takeoff instead of ones that are returning, because the fuel density and the amount of fuel in the aircraft taking off is far greater than that of those aircraft that are landing. Nonetheless, they could take out either, but you can imagine that if they were to destroy an aircraft just as it's taking off, or maybe it hasn't even taken off and it's proximate to other aircraft, imagine what would happen. And again, maybe the AT-4 or the Carl Gustav or a shoulder-fired missile like an RPG that is not designed to go from ground to air, but it's ground to ground. What happens if you hit loaded aircraft loading human beings at the carousels themselves, where people are boarding the aircraft once the boarding call comes. So what does that look like? Well, it looks particularly ugly, and it puts airports out of business for days, weeks, possibly months. So we could go on with blue sky prognostications of what this would look like. Again, I urge you to read Fortune's book. I urge you to read Schlichter's book. There's noise and chatter being discovered or talked about Chechens coming over the border or any variety of Islamist or jihadists. Since we are narrowly focused on that, it doesn't mean that there can't be others like Chinese operatives, things like that. But we're just concentrating on the jihadist threat, because the jihadist threat is the most logical threat that is fire and forget, where on that day across the country, you can activate these cells with a phone call, and these cells do their damage until they're burned down or killed. How does America prepare for this? Well, I don't think it can be. And inevitably, if we look back on American government responses to these kind of things, even with institutional infrastructure crashes, and you know, we've had bridges go out, we've had ship collisions with bridges, we've had mass fires, things like that, going back to 9-1-1, all of these things. America, 23 years after 9-1-1, is still not prepared for the kind of rising that could take place that I've described in what is now three episodes, including the previous two I did, 37 and 41, which I recommend, if you get a chance, listen to them in sequence. So what can America do to stop this? Well, the two answers that I have to that, and please keep in mind, I'm a member of neither political party, and nor am I liberal or conservative, but these two points are very important if you want to ameliorate the effects of this. Number one, illegal immigration at both borders, Canada and Mexico, if not the permeable water borders at the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans on those respective states. It has to be settled immediately. It has to be stopped. And we need, as a country, as a government, get a hold in a census and a canvas of who and what has come in here and what are they doing and where are they at? It's like the in the intelligence circus, what you have is you have association matrices where you have a mass whiteboard and you start saying, for instance, let's suppose I was looking at the IRA in Great Britain. We would find one bomber, and we would start trying through association matrices. Well, who does he talk to? Who are the financiers? Who's he connected to politically? Who are the shooters? Who are the trigger pullers? Who are the auxiliaries? Who are the active auxiliaries? Who are the passive auxiliaries? And the passive auxiliaries are those folks who would say, well, it's not my business. I'm not paying attention to it, and I'm not going to identify them as being a threat, whatever the case may be. So immigration is a major issue, legal immigration, illegal immigration, because that has shaped the conditions for having unknown quantities of young military men, because men of military age, which is up to the age of 35, will be the primary interlocutors and participants in this particular thing. So you've got to get a hold of immigration. The other thing that we discovered when I talked about this in episode 37 is that in Israel, despite their vaunted public relations and propaganda efforts, 1% of their population can have a handgun, much less a rifle. One can carry a rifle or a handgun if you're on reserve duty or actually in the IDF. As far as I know, and somebody can disabuse me of this notion, if you are in active military service or on your reserve drill weekend, the bearing and possession of firearms is permitted. But let's suppose you're not on your drill weekend, you're not in the IDF, only 1% of them can have a weapon, they can have one weapon, and they're authorized 50 rounds a year. Now, as a result of this, when you look at the after-action reviews and some of the interviews that took place after October 7th, 2023 in Gaza, everyone in the West assumed, well, they're armed to the teeth. Well, they're not armed to the teeth. And that atomistic placement of firearms, whether rifle or pistol, and in the case of everyday affairs, pistol, I carry one every day. I carry one in the house, is you have it on you and you can immediately service threats at that very moment. So 1% there. In America, we have constitutional carry states, which means that you need neither a permit to carry open nor a permit to carry concealed. I'd rather use the term discreet, but I'll go with concealed since that is the lexicon most people use. That means that in 28 states, if this very thing were to happen, you have a far larger likelihood of firearms being concealed on people's persons at the infrastructure level, at the mall, at the public space. Well, of course, we all know that the gun-free zones will be the schools and any government complexes, so they will be doubly in the hazard as a result of that. But let's suppose it's a shopping mall. Despite shopping malls having the signs posted where they say that you cannot carry here, I know on good authority that I and a number of my friends, we don't take that too seriously when it comes to that. So if they were to attack in a mall, especially in those 28 states that have constitutional carry, they would probably discover atomistically that they will be met immediately by fire once they try to do that. Now, in the other 22 states, among which are the most populous states, like California and the Northeast in America, places like Michigan and Minnesota, you'll find that they probably don't have that. So that means that ultimately, if this were to happen tomorrow morning, God's forbid it, that those states would suffer a much higher number of casualties as a direct result of their gun laws disarming folks who are wandering about and simply want to protect themselves, their friends, their family. So those are two of the items that I think would make it more optimal for American survival in this kind of attack. That would be an upscaled October 7th Gaza-style attack on Israel, would be upscaled in numbers, density, and probably firearms and targeting than was done there. Both of these observations are completely reliant on government behavior. And the first, of course, with immigration, it's up to the government and not private individuals to stem the tide on the southern border, for instance, of folks coming in seeking asylum for whom biometric or identification data is probably so insufficient that many military-age males have come into the country and find themselves available for conducting the kind of things that I've just spent nearly the last hour describing. Government is also in charge, of course, for the atomistic distribution and unfettered bearing of firearms, which would lead to a far greater response and far more spontaneous response to any kind of violence that's taken up by these cells in America. And let's keep in mind, you live in a state that just so happens to have some very egregious laws against your ability to carry and to protect your friends and family. Keep in mind that when Anne Frank was found in the attic in Holland, she was protected by people breaking the law, and the young men who came and kidnapped her, took her away, put her in a concentration camp, and eventually murdered her were following the law. Law and morality are not the same thing and never have been. For the most part, I would caution all of you to anticipate this possibly happening. Review plans with your family. Make yourself harder to be injured or killed by increasing your situational awareness. Take a look at Jeff Cooper's color code matrix on what to happen in situations in which you may be in the hazard. Pay attention to what's going on around you. Have an extinguisher in your car. Consider getting body armor. Consider going and getting training. Consider having firearms in the first place if you don't happen to have them. And if you happen to have a friend or family member, let me reverse that. If you happen to have a family member or a friend who's conversant in firearms and you aren't, take advantage of the skills and the knowledge they have. If you have to pay for training, pay for training. It's something we used to say. If you have a $10 head, you get a $10 helmet. I hate to say this, and it makes me a bit sad to say it, but I think that this is more of a when and not an if. I think the very things that Schlichter and Fortune and probably other authors who my listeners will make me aware of, and I would urge you, reach out to me and let me know if there are other books that postulate something like this or adjacent events that are like it. Maybe you can even turn me on to historical events where this happened. For instance, we know what happened to the Russians in a theater recently, which was sort of replicated or echoes to what the Chechens did nearly 20 years ago at a government school in Russia proper, and what happened there. Awful things. All of these things are eminently preventable, not only through the two examples I brought up about immigration and atomistic and unfettered weapons carry in America, but through a variety of things, like I just mentioned about your situational awareness, your situational understanding, what's going on around you, what's going on in your neighborhood, making sure that neighbors are paying attention, and making sure that you are in a position where myself, as a father and a husband, I have two jobs, providing and protecting, maybe protecting and providing in these times. I take that very seriously, and I would urge all the men and women in my audience to do the very same thing. So I'm going to continue in the series where either in the next episode or in an episode somewhere in the future, I will talk about what I think's going to be the aftermath of this unfortunate episode that I think is probabilistic in the American future. Schlichter takes a view. I'm not going to spoil it. Fortune takes a view. I'm not going to spoil it. But they're diametrically opposed in how they say the American government responds. So with that, I wanted to thank all my listeners for listening to my show. Please pass it on to other people who you think may be interested. I so appreciate your solicitude. I look forward to your comments on my Substack. I am at W. Bupert, Chasing Ghost Podcast, but it's at W. Bupert on Twitter. Love to see you comment there or even say, hey, take a listen to this episode or others that you find interesting. If you wish to converse with me, write me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. This is Bill, out.